Do you want to reduce stress and get better sleep? I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman with exciting news about an effective non-drug solution. The Zen by Nuvana. It's a safe, easy way to reduce stress and anxiety, improve your mood, sleep, and focus naturally. Zen is state-of-the-art. It connects to patented earbuds and uses your music to safely and conveniently deliver electronic signals that stimulate your vagus nerve, a major communication pathway between the brain and most major organs. The Nuvana app links Zen to your mobile device using Bluetooth so you can easily control and customize your experience. Choose from a variety of signal patterns to find what works best for you. Zen is safe, easy, and effective. And for a limited time, get 20% off the exclusive Intelligent Medicine Bundle. For more information and to order, go to NuvanaLife.com/Hoffman. That's Nuvana, N-E-U-V-A-N-A. NuvanaLife.com/Hoffman. Stress less. Focus more. Sleep better. Electronically. The Zen by Nuvana.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Layla Mutin. I weigh in once a week on topics of interest, questions that you email me. The email to send me questions and topics of interest is radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. So if you'd like to subscribe to the newsletter, if you don't, I mean, go to drhoffman.com and subscribe. It's free. Comes out once a week, just like my weighing in podcast here. And you can unsubscribe at any time. Okay. If you'd like to make an appointment, call the office, 212-779-1744. 212-779-1744. I'm going to dive into this question here from Julie. Hi, Layla. I'm a fairly healthy 64-year-old woman. I was recently diagnosed with SIBO and tested high in hydrogen and low in methane. My doctor has put me on a regimen of digestive enzymes, omega spore biotic, biocidin. Biocidin's really good. She's also going to put me on a low-carb diet. Before I got the results of the test, however, I put myself on a low FODMAP diet. FODMAP diet is often suggested for SIBO. SIBO is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, right? And you could either be high in hydrogen or high in methane. Julie's high in hydrogen, low in methane. There are different, the diet, that's the kind of the spectrum of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And oftentimes we want to get rid of that bacteria using botanicals like biocidin. Biocidin is great. I also like candibactin, BR, and AR. Digestive enzymes are also helpful for those who are experiencing any kind of bloating or anything like that. Maybe then a probiotic. But here's the thing. Julie, you were given by your doctor omega spore biotic. That's great. What we find, and it's a little bit of different strokes for different folks, some people with SIBO do well taking a probiotic right away. Other people, we like to give them the probiotic later once we have eliminated the SIBO, once we've eliminated that small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Because we find in some people who are susceptible, by giving them probiotics too early, while that SIBO is still apparent or acute, those probiotics may kind of join the party, so to speak, and feed more of the bad bacteria. That's why we wait. But everybody is different. So, Julie says, before I got the results of the test, I put myself on a low FODMAP diet. This diet actually did away with the diarrhea I was experiencing, as well as the slight nauseous feelings and bloating. What are your thoughts on the diet? Low carb or low FODMAP? As a side note, I do miss my garlic and onions on the low FODMAP diet. Thank you and love the show. Julie, thanks for this question. So FODMAP is the acronym, F-O-D-M-A-P, is the acronym for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. These, that was a mouthful, right? So just say FODMAP. These are fermentable carbohydrates. And these fermentable carbohydrates are known in susceptible people to feed bad bacteria in the gut. So by going on a low FODMAP diet, by removing many of these fermentable carbohydrates, let me name some. Besides the garlic and onions that Julie mentions, those are FODMAPs, asparagus, mushrooms, apples, broccoli, cabbage, right? Naming a few, gluten, lactose like dairy, milk is problematic. Any sugar alcohols? Yes, sugar alcohols. Those of you who are following a low-carb diet and taking sugar alcohol products, because sugar alcohols are not counted or the body doesn't recognize them as carbohydrate in the diet, they kind of pass through. But they can pass through a little bit viciously if you let it, if you have too much. Sugar alcohols like sorbitol, maltitol, xylitol, erythritol, they can cause a laxative-like reaction, causing bloating, diarrhea, all of that thing, right? Who needs that? So be careful with that. So a low FODMAP diet is great for people with SIBO. That's where I kind of start them, is a low FODMAP diet. Often that does the trick. And you know, I don't give them a very, very, very lengthy list of FODMAP foods to avoid because that can often be overwhelming. I give a short list in my office of foods that are most problematic, garlic and onions being some of them, right? So it's best to start there and then getting rid of the SIBO, the intestinal bacterial overgrowth, with botanicals and other things possibly. Doctors have often prescribed Xifaxan, which is an antibiotic, very expensive antibiotic. And some people have done well with that, others not so much. Others have needed more than one round of the Xifaxan. And I'll tell you, in extreme cases of SIBO, I found the specific carbohydrate diet to be ideal, specific carbohydrate diet. If you're interested in that, go to breakingthevicious cycle.info. Breaking the Vicious Cycle is the late Elaine Gottschall's book on the specific carbohydrate diet. I would recommend anybody with any digestive disturbances or SIBO or anything, pick it up. Take a look at it. You can go to their official website, which is breakingthevicious cycle.info, I-N-F-O. So Julie's asking me, so low carb or low FODMAP? Well, here's the thing. Your doctor recommended very astutely a low carb diet because there are so many carbohydrates that are fermentable and she's taking care of basically all of them, right? So, and that's fine. And I have also put people with SIBO on a low carb diet, especially when I investigate and see their diet history was very high in all kinds of carbohydrates, not just the FODMAPs. I say, whoa, cereal with milk and a banana. Well, the banana's okay, but, you know, it's not a FODMAP, meaning it's not a FODMAP. It's still high in carbs. You know, the cereal with milk, all of the, hey, that's a problem. That's a lot of fermentable carbohydrate right there. So Julie, if low FODMAP worked for you and that was as far as you needed to go, that's fine. You could do a low carb diet that's beneficial for other things also, besides SIBO, for things like weight loss, bringing down triglycerides if your triglycerides are too high, if there's insulin resistance. But I like what your doctor did with the biocidin, especially the digestive enzymes. It sounds like you're in really good hands. So these are the ways to go. A low FODMAP diet first for SIBO, and Julie, you took that upon yourself to put yourself on a low FODMAP diet. Now, the list I give out is a smaller list for my patients. However, you could download an app. It's an Australian university, Monash, M-O-N-A-S-H, Monash University. There's an app you can download. They have a very, very long list, however, of FODMAP foods. And I have found in the past that many of my patients or clients would look at that list and say, well, what's left to eat? This is very big. So basically, we've drilled down the list a little bit to the most offending foods that I find 90% of the time takes care of the matter of SIBO. And by the way, if you have SIBO, you don't have to be on a low FODMAP diet for the rest of your life. It's just until the SIBO is cleared up. We don't want you not eating cabbage and broccoli and asparagus and garlic and onions forever. We don't want that. These are nutritious foods. And I'll often get that, but Layla, these are nutritious foods. Why do I have to eliminate them? You're only eliminating them for a period of time until this condition or these symptoms diminish or abate. They go away. We take care of the matter. And then you reintroduce those foods. Then you'll be able to eat the broccoli and the cabbage and the asparagus and the mushrooms and the garlic and the onions and the apples and so forth. So it's all good. This is a therapeutic diet, a low FODMAP diet, as is a low carb diet. So Julie, thank you very much for your question. And for everybody else, just to remind you, the email is radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. Okay. And now I want to talk to you. You know, we keep hearing about 1 week coffee is good, the other week coffee is bad, so forth and so on. Well, get this. Following a bad night of sleep, drink coffee after breakfast, not before. Strong coffee first thing in the morning after a lousy night's sleep might seem like a good idea, but it actually isn't, according to researchers. The reason? The combination reduces glucose tolerance. So it's a much better idea to have breakfast first, then coffee, the team reports in the British Journal of Nutrition. Each of the 29 participants in the randomized crossover study consumed a sugary drink in the morning after experiencing each of three sets of experimental conditions: a typical night's sleep, a disrupted night's sleep, and the third is a disrupted night's sleep followed by a strong black coffee. The sugary drink was intended to stimulate the calorie intake of a typical breakfast. And as measured by oral glucose tolerance tests, the mean peak glucose and the mean peak insulin were significantly higher in participants after the fragmented sleep plus coffee experiences versus the fragmented sleep only. So if you've had a bad night's sleep, don't just drink that coffee on an empty stomach. You want to eat breakfast first, then have the coffee. And hey, this is another reason for all of you out there who believe you are fasting for a blood test when you've had a cup of black coffee. Don't do it. Because the caffeine in your coffee, even if you're having decaf, because there's still some residual caffeine there, may actually spike your blood sugar a little bit. And you'll get a false fasting glucose reading, won't you? So don't even have that cup of coffee. Don't have it for any blood test or any doctor's appointment. Don't do it. You should come in fasting if your doctor's office is advising you to come into their office fasting. But for most blood draws, you should be fasting. And that means no coffee. So coming back to this, the present study demonstrates that one night of hourly sleep fragmentation had no effect on next day insulin sensitivity or glucose tolerance relative to a habitual night of sleep in young, healthy men and women. However, Consumption of caffeinated coffee after sleep fragmentation increased glucose incremental area under the curve by approximately 50%. Increased the glucose by 50%. And that's after a bad night's sleep. And it could be similar, you know, otherwise just having that coffee, bad night's sleep or not. So the researchers caution that the findings of this acute study would not apply to somebody routinely doing this, as it is more likely that there would be a shift in their circadian rhythms or body clocks to adapt to this routine. It's been well established that sleep deprivation or broken or fragmented sleep can impair glucose clearance and insulin sensitivity. Further, the researchers note a single serving of caffeinated coffee has been shown to acutely impair postprandial glucose metabolism in both normal weight and overweight individuals. The participants' mean age was 21. They had no diagnosed metabolic disease, and they all slept in their own beds for the experimental Sleep fragmentation was caused by audible alarms every hour on the hour throughout the night. Ugh, imagine that. Followed by multiple text messages from a researcher that required simple responses before the participant could fall asleep again. Oy, I wouldn't want to take part in that study, would you? But this is important information, right? Under the fragmented sleep plus coffee portion of the study, participants drank a cup of instant coffee containing about 300 milligrams of caffeine about an hour after waking up. The sugary drink consumed in each part of the study contained about 75 grams of glucose. Whew. Dr. Robert Gabbe, Chief Scientific and Medical Officer for the American Diabetes Association, told Reuters, and this is from Reuters Health, sleep deprivation is important and worsens diabetes control and the resistance to the effects of insulin. Caffeine is known to raise blood sugar in some individuals, he continued, whether they do or do not have diabetes. And that's why I'm telling all of you, don't have the cup of coffee on an empty stomach. Research data generally suggest that coffee consumption lowers the risk of diabetes, probably because, quote, in part, caffeine and coffee have a number of other effects beyond the ones studied here, such as coffee drinkers being more active in the morning, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, right, with your cup of Java. Dr. Gabbe, who was not involved in the study, concluded, caffeine's effects on blood glucose are complex, but this study represents some interesting new data, the clinical significance of which is somewhat unclear. But listen, I have told patients and clients, and I'm telling all of you, if you have any kind of blood sugar issue or that caffeine is hitting you too hard, it is causing some abnormal change in your glucose level, even though you didn't eat breakfast yet. So I want you to keep that in mind. You were better off, start to eat your breakfast and then start sipping that coffee. But if you're an exerciser in the morning and you need to feel a little warm, meaning a little something hot in your tummy, a little hot beverage, and you're looking for a little bit of a caffeine boost to get you going to the gym and get you started, I know many people that will drink a small cup or a half cup of black coffee just to get warm, just to wake, just to get started. That's okay. You're going to exercise. And as long as you feel fine, it's all good. But the days that you're going for a blood draw, you're going to the doctor's office, you're getting your blood pressure checked. And here's another scenario. I can't tell you how many times I've had patients, they were given prescriptions for blood pressure medication because they were found to have high blood pressure when they arrived at the doctor's office that morning and their blood pressure was taken. right? Because they had a cup of coffee that morning. Listen, for many people, because if you're a habitual coffee drinker, it may not bother you, your body will adjust. But some people are slow metabolizers of caffeine. That's a genetic SNP. That's a genetic abnormality or mutation. I don't want to call it an abnormality. It's really not. If you have the SNP where you're a slow metabolizer of caffeine, that's what's going on. And what happens? It constricts blood vessels. When our blood vessels are constricted, like angiotensin hormone delivered by the kidneys, then our blood pressure goes up. So think, blood pressure medications, many of them are angiotensin agonists, right? They kind of keep that angiotensin hormone from being secreted to keep your blood vessels from constricting and causing high blood pressure. Well, guess what? The caffeine in your coffee is doing just that. And it may be that you just need to not have that coffee or switch to decaf if it's causing high blood pressure in you. Another very important note, talking about blood pressure now, because I still see this reported way too often. When you're having your blood pressure taken at your physician's office, you should not be answering questions or talking while your blood pressure is being measured, because that can raise your blood pressure. Bet you didn't know that. Also, your legs should not be crossed when you're sitting. Both of your feet should be on the ground when you're having your blood pressure taken. That also means your feet should not be dangling off the exam table either when you have your blood pressure taken. This may cause an abnormal rise in your blood pressure. And the arm that the blood pressure cuff is on should be supported. In other words, you should not be holding up the weight of your arm yourself. It should be supported either by the arm of your chair, the desk that you're sitting next to, or by the practitioner taking your blood pressure. You should not be supporting the weight of your arm, because that can raise your blood pressure. And no talking. And no coffee. And then you should be able to get a correct blood pressure reading. And so there you go. I want to thank you for joining me on another edition of Layla Weighs In, here on Intelligent Medicine. This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.